Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. How far should an editorial page go? We'll discuss the Boston Globe's front page wrap this morning of a life-size semi-automatic rifle and the words, "Make it stop." Also, the Duxbury couple who set up an Ask a Muslim booth in the Boston area, how do they respond to questions like, is a person who kills in the name of Islam really a Muslim?
Not Muslims that have gone astray, not Muslims who have gotten the right idea or who somehow interpreted the Quran wrong. No, they're not Muslims, just like the KKK are not Christian despite any, you know, attempts.
Plus, Microsoft buys LinkedIn.
Our customers are going to see these new delightful scenarios by bringing together their professional cloud and their professional network.
And a chilling crime novel explores loyalty, crime, and race in 1970s Brighton. That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Democratic lawmakers have said it. Gun control activists have said it. Today, the Boston Globe said it too, loud and clear, in a special section wrapped around the front page. They said, "Make it stop." That's what's written in huge type over the Globe's editorial section today, which also featured a photograph of a semi-automatic rifle shown in actual size. The headline also runs in a large banner at the top of the Globe's website. Click on that and you get a special interactive editorial that asks readers to click on a link to tweet and email six senators who, quote, stand in the way of gun control. One click and readers send a pre-written tweet that reads, quote, "The U.S. must ban semi-automatic weapons. Please help us end mass shootings." Well, the Globe has done this before, making a gutsy editorial the de facto front page. But should it be doing that? Is the newspaper declaring that the once vaunted wall between the newsroom and the editorial page a thing of the past? Well, Ethan Zuckerman has some perspective on this. He's the director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
So first of all, Ethan, tell me, I mean, what did you think about today's Globe editorial that, as I'm calling it, served as the de facto front page?
Well, I think it is the front page. I think everyone's discussing it as the front page. I thought it was an extremely gutsy move. I thought it was surprising, but not at all inappropriate. I think it is a moment at which many people around the world are wondering when the United States is going to do something meaningful on gun control. And I think this is a newsroom that looked at this and said, we simply can't report this passively anymore. This is a moment at which it's not a matter of balancing between two sides. We really have to talk about how absurd the situation is in the United States at the moment.
Right. And I mean, not just talk about, but the Globe is encouraging people to take action. So as you said, the opposite of passivity. I mean, as we mentioned, the editorial on the website just takes you directly to a little box where you can click one link and you send a tweet to these six senators they've identified, including New Hampshire's Kelly Ayotte, for asking them to help move congressional legislation on gun control. Is that unusual for a newspaper to make it that easy to take some form of action?
It's unusual, but I don't think it's unprecedented. And I think there's a pretty good argument that it's the right thing for a newspaper to be doing. So first of all, the U.S. tends to have a stance against advocacy journalism. We tend to have this very strong sense that we want our newspapers to give us all sides of the story. The place where we are not as insistent about this is on the editorial page. And so we're comfortable with the editorial page endorsing political candidates, but we don't expect it generally to be part of the rest of the newspaper. That attitude is less common in other parts of the world. So for instance, the Guardian newspaper in London did a big campaign more than a year ago where they partnered with 350.org, the climate change organization, and actively rallied readers to start pressuring two large charitable trusts to divest from fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So in that particular case, that newspaper essentially designed a campaign and tried to mobilize its readers over the course of weeks and months to get active around the issue.
Right. So, Ethan, if I can just jump in here, I mean, The Guardian's a really interesting example because it has a long history of being a crusading liberal newspaper. I think even if in its charter it's written that that is its mission, but that's not the same for the Boston Globe. I mean, they did receive some pushback from some readers. Someone put on NECN's Facebook post about the Globe, someone commented that the Boston Globe should report the news and not play politics. So is the Globe at risk of readers believing that it has compromised its journalistic neutrality in the rest of the paper by putting this kind of activist editorial on the front page?
Sure. The U.S. has different attitudes towards this than Europe generally has. And generally speaking, in a lot of the rest of the world, we're used to more advocacy coming from our journalism organization. In the U.S., we've seen pretty strong adherence to this idea that we want to be politically neutral, except on the editorial page. What's interesting is that that's changing, and it's changing as the media is changing. Newspapers are perhaps the last to change in all of this, but we've certainly seen cable news networks getting very active in trying to mobilize their viewers. We've seen Fox News literally inviting people to participate in political rallies. And we've certainly seen digital native media be less shy about this aspiration to objectivity than we have the traditional newspapers. I want to make the argument that the Globe may be doing something very important here. I think a real danger for the mainstream press at the moment is that we end up giving readers learned helplessness. We feel like we're telling people the story, but we're not telling people anything that they can actually do about it. And so what happens is, in the case of these mass shootings, we hear again and again and again about these tragedies. And it's very, very easy to read this and end up at a point where you feel completely helpless, even if you're well-informed.
Yeah.
What the Globe is now doing is going a step further and saying, look, we think it's time to help you figure out as a citizen how you would take effective action on this if you believe that action is what needs to be taken.
Right. So,
in that sense, I think they're actually fighting against a much deeper danger than losing some of their program readers. I think they're fighting against losing their relevancy in general.
Yeah. So on that point, I should note that we did reach out to the Globe and asked Globe editor Brian McGrory if he could join us, and we also asked Ellen Clegg, who's the editorial page editor, if she could join us. They were both unable to, but they did send us a statement in which Ellen Clegg wrote in the statement that the Boston Globe has pulled together these facts and this editorial about semi-automatic weapons and mass shootings to encourage a national conversation. What can we do to make it stop? What do we want for future generations? We hope our words speak for themselves. So finally, Ethan, I'm curious. Dan Kennedy, you know, a very well-regarded media critic and analyst here in the Boston area, wrote today that the problem with such campaigns is that even when they're effective at making their case, they're ineffective in actually changing anyone's minds. And I'm wondering if you think that's true, and if so, what does that mean for the Globe's attempts to do so?
So I think it's incredibly difficult to change people's minds around issues like gun control. I think it's one of these issues where many people have actually thought about it and probably have fairly well-established points of view on it. Where I do think there's the possibility of changing minds is essentially in saying, look, we probably can't solve the whole problem of how the United States regulates or doesn't regulate firearms, but here is an issue where it may be time to say we need to make a change around it. And this question of semi-automatic, large magazine capacity weapons seems like a place where there might be the ability of mobilizing people who are aware of the fact that these mass shootings are happening very regularly, are aware of the fact that these mass shootings often are using these AR-15 style weapons, and building political momentum around the idea of doing something specifically on that front. I don't know that the Globe's work today, which I'm an admirer of, is necessarily going to change a lot of minds. I do think it's going to help readers who feel helpless around this issue find a way to be more active as citizens. And I think that's a great thing for newspapers to be doing, to help people take action as citizens. Where it's probably not helpful is for people who don't end up agreeing with the Globe's stance and are likely to feel somewhat alienated by this. I think the Globe made a brave move deciding that they were willing to alienate some readers and work on this question of helping other readers mobilize and make a change.
Ethan Zuckerman is the director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT. Ethan, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Well, the Globe's editorial that we've been talking about was, of course, inspired by the Orlando shooting. Here in Boston, mourners remembered another victim of gun violence as they filled the Charles Street African Methodist Episcopal Church in Dorchester today. They were there for funeral services for 17-year-old Raekwon Brown. He's the junior who was shot and killed near the Jeremiah Burke High School last week. Yolanda Williams shared memories of her cousin.
Loving, kind, a teddy bear, a real teddy bear. Somebody just that was always there for you.
Williams also said that there aren't enough alternatives in Boston to help young people turn away from violence.
I mean, the kids have nothing nowadays. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have nothing. Mm-hmm. We used to have all these programs growing up. Mm-hmm. Now we have nothing. Mm-hmm. And all these, I mean, he wasn't hanging out, but whomever did this, they see that as a way of life.
That's Yolanda Williams, cousin of 17-year-old Raekwon Brown. Boston police and Suffolk District Attorney Dan Connolly are continuing their investigation into the shooting. They have not yet identified a suspect and are asking the public to come forward with any information they might have. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We want to now bring back two guests, whom you might have heard on the show back in April. They are Mona Haidar and Sebastian Robbins, and they are the Duxbury couple who set up an Ask a Muslim booth in the Boston area, where they offer passersby the chance to talk, ask questions about Islam, engage in some dialogue, complete with donuts and coffee. And as all of us from every kind of community imaginable continue to try to understand what happened in Orlando, we thought it would be a good time to see how Mona and Sebastian are thinking about this moment. So they're with us now. Mona and Sebastian, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, listeners, we also want to hear from you. Maybe we can call this sort of a radio version of your Ask a Muslim booth. So if you have a question for Mona Haidar and Sebastian Robbins about Islam or their impressions of this moment following the shootings in Orlando, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Mona and Sebastian, I first of all just want to play a little bit of tape from you because a little earlier in this week we had a chance to speak with a Boston writer and video game designer. His name is To Zaman. He's also Muslim. And we asked him about what his first reactions were after finding out what happened in Orlando. And here's what he said.
A lot of particularly Muslim identifying people also have a very similar reaction 5 seconds later, which is oh my God, please don't let this guy be a Muslim.
Was that similar to how you first felt?
Oh yeah, I think the heartbreak over somebody who supposedly shares your faith doing something inconceivable is just so heart-wrenching and psychologically traumatic. Mm-hmm. For so many Muslims, we all experience that. Like, how can that be real?
Yeah. And Sebastian?
Yeah, ditto. In fact, it didn't occur to me until Mona started telling me some of the details. I hadn't read the news. And there was just this gut-wrenching, gut-sinking feeling of no, just this. It was almost, and I think for a lot of people, you were tempted to bypass the grief and go into this sense of defensiveness and go into the sense of, I wonder what kind of backlash is going to come. And we've seen that this week. And then below that is just tremendous sadness, but there was certainly that sense of going two steps backward.
Yeah. So have you had a chance to put up the Ask a Muslim table and booth since this weekend?
We haven't, but one of the ideas that we've toyed with is the big rainbow flag, just flying it high and proud and saying, we're here, we're Muslim, and we're proud to have you know, this this amazing American identity, which allows people to express their identities, whatever they are, with the full freedom that we have in this country. So, you know, just as a statement of solidarity and utter, you know, like support, we have nothing else but that for the community, the LGBTQ community right now.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because obviously that's a major part of this conversation, because one of the first things that was reported after the horrible shooting was that the shooter was very homophobic, yeah. Profoundly homophobic, to the point where, you know, he apparently had said that seeing two men kiss on the street disgusted him. And it's been very complicated since then with lots of speculation around the shooter himself. But Islam and its relationship to the LGBT community has come up a lot. And there seems to be a lot of differing opinion on that. I mean, there are people out there who say that, you know, the clerical elite in Islam is not welcoming and actively preaches against the LGBT community. And what's your response to that?
I just want to say a couple of things to start. I mean, first, you know, we've seen some very disturbing comments on every point of the spectrum, from the far right to some of these people that you're talking about. And obviously, this is, you know, not the time, you know, for these people to be making these kinds of statements. It's obviously not helpful. We are lay people. You know, we're not scholars. Just, you know, before Mona talks, I just want to say one of the things that's been most heartening has been hearing members of the LGBTQ community standing up and say, we're not going to take the low road and use this as an opportunity to blame Muslims, and specifically reaching out to us and saying, look, you know, we are grieving along with you all, because it's Muslims who are grieving at a time like this, and also Muslims reaching out, you know, the other way and saying, look, we're all in this together. And so for me as an individual, those kind of scholarly decisions or whatever don't really jump over the human side of things, because that's what really matters. Those kind of decisions don't matter to me as much as humanity. And that's, I think, one beautiful thing that has come out of this tragedy has been people coming together and saying, look, we are both groups being persecuted. We are both groups being targeted right now.
Okay, so Mona, pretend the booth was up. Mm-hmm. Again, this is the radio version of the booth. And someone did come up to you and asked you, is Islam homophobic? How would you answer that?
Yeah, I would say Islam is nothing. And what Islam does is it gives somebody a Muslim identity, and a person with a Muslim identity can do whatever they will with that identity. And for me, as a human being who expresses my spirituality through the lens of Islam, I'm not homophobic. I actually have very dear and beloved friends who are queer and gay and lesbian and da 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 da. And what that says to me is that even though I am a practitioner of my faith, my code of the way that I want to live my life is not for me to put upon anyone else. And that's not my job as a Muslim. It's not my job as an American. It's not my job in any field, in any part of my life. What I am interested in doing is being a human being on the path to enlightenment, using Islam as a tool to that end. And one of the things that I need to do to attain that end is to be kind and loving and merciful and compassionate. And I don't see that as having anything to do with homophobia or transphobia or anti-Semitism. I see those as counter to that.
Yeah.
So it's about building relationships, and you can't do that while hating another or being phobic of another.
Hmm. Well, we're speaking with Sebastian Robbins and Mona Haidar. They are the Duxbury couple who have an Ask a Muslim table that they've put up around the Boston area, where they encourage people to come to them and ask any questions they might have about Islam, to engender dialogue, conversation. just, you know, a good old-fashioned get to know you, which we can't do enough of it. And I'm saying that being a person who talks for a living, can't do enough of that. They're joining us today to talk about how they're processing what happened in Orlando and to take questions from you as well. So we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And looks like we've got Steve, who's calling from Manchester. You're on the air, Steve.
Thanks. One thing that always has struck me each time a tragedy like this happens is that the response of my friends who are Muslim is almost universally, this is a tragedy, I feel terrible for the people involved, and this is really offensive to our faith. And it really is an almost universal comment that comes unbidden. You know, this is really against what we feel and what our religion calls for. And I don't see that in tragedies in other religions after an event like this. You know, there's no sort of, for example, Christian equivalent. And it strikes me that this is really a vital part of Islam.
Steve, thank you so much for your thoughts and your call. Sebastian, you're nodding your head, yes.
Well, so many thoughts. I'm not sure what he meant by this being a vital part of Islam, but I think Muslims have been on the defensive for a very, very long time, way before 9/11. For lots of different reasons, we are lumped together as a monolithic group, despite being close to 2 billion people. So I certainly can sympathize with Steve's friends who have that sense of defensiveness and wanting to distance themselves. I'm just going to try out a crazy metaphor here, but I've been thinking for the last couple months what moderate mainstream Republicans must have thought when Donald Trump stands up and says, I am a Republican. There are certainly many, many Republicans who are very much against his view and what he's doing. And I think that is very similar for Muslims like Mona and myself and the 99.99% others who see these people say, oh, suddenly I'm going to do this in the name of the you know, the worst possible thing, and I'm going to do it in the name of your religion.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So how then do you react, or what do you feel or think when people like Donald Trump, in a way, are using that same example, and they say, well, the Muslim community in America should stand up even more and be even more vocal in opposition to these terrorist acts? That, you know, just this week he said the Muslim community ought to be doing more about reporting to law enforcement from within their own community.
Sure.
I mean that's sort of the other end of the extreme.
Sure.
Mona,
we do. We absolutely do all of those things. And what my question is to somebody like Donald Trump, instead of being such a negative Nancy, what is he doing to support Muslim Americans who are working towards the ends of safety and peace and love in the world, instead of just harping and coming down so hard and, you know, using his platform to basically divide and conquer this country? I don't see that as supportive of anybody, especially not Muslim Americans. And, you know, one of the things that I'd love to share with the audience is just this story of somebody who, on my Facebook page, after I shared my heartache over all of this that has happened in Orlando, somebody said to me, you know, I live in Orlando, I am gay, and I actually go to the club where the shooting happened. And I want you to know that I'm standing with you. And I read this and I just started weeping. And this amazing human being who is being put in a position to say all Muslims did this to me and my community. And instead taking that opportunity to come out and say to a Muslim, you know, I'm with you and I stand with you.
Yeah.
I just found that so beautiful.
Yeah, we have a bunch more callers here. Let's see how many of them we can get to. John is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, John.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just have a very quick question. I want to ask if you think a Muslim overseas thinks differently about their religion opposed to a Muslim living in America because of the environmental difference, the economic difference, and just, you know, what they're surrounded by every day.
Interesting question, John. Thank you.
I think the answer to that is absolutely, absolutely, John. I am a Muslim with an American culture. The same way that, you know, jerk chicken is Jamaican, is from the Jamaican culture. It is not a part of Rastafarianism. So, you know, for me as a Muslim American with American culture, my sensibilities are very American. And for somebody who is elsewhere, their sensibilities and their culture reflect that. So people often ask me, you know, what about Muslims? What about Muslim women? And how does Islam treat women? Well, I'm like, what culture is that person coming from? And that'll tell you about how they treat their women or how women are esteemed or regarded.
So let me just jump in here, because I think what that makes me wonder is, how would you answer the question if someone said, well, yeah, so in America, there's a certain set of broad-based cultural values. Obviously, they're different within different groups. But like you just said, I mean, they're grounded in the history and environment of the United States, which includes many different people from around the world and different faiths. So it means maybe one thing to be a member of the Muslim faith in the United States, but it means another thing entirely in Saudi Arabia. And the reason why I ask that is, you know, I'm still thinking about the LGBT question, because there are countries in the rest of the world, Muslim countries, where leaders of those nations who also profess to follow Islam are very actively and vocally anti-LGBT. So do you see him saying, like yes, the context matters a lot, but it's done under the umbrella of the same faith.
Yeah. So what I would use right there is the idea that they profess to represent Islam. Most of these countries that profess that, they actually, you know, they do nothing of the sort. You know, Saudi Arabia, for me, is the crazy uncle of the family who everybody just kind of is embarrassed of.
Except that's where Mecca is.
Well, geographically, yes. But the spirit of the place and the culture of the place is very much, you know, represented by Saudi Arabian strict and rigid and harsh language and spirit. So I'm not really interested in that. And, you know, for me, it all boils down to, what are you using Islam as a tool for? Are you using it for your ego? Are you using it for your heart? Are you using it for connection? Because ultimately, that's what it's for. And countries that use it to punish and to harm and to close themselves, you know, off to dialogue and to progress, that's not using Islam properly. So maybe they profess Islam.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, I have a couple more questions about how the two of you have to maybe steel yourselves or harden yourselves to, I'm not going to say it. I don't want to say it's going to happen again, but we had it in San Bernardino. Yeah. Now we have it in Orlando. Yeah. Do you feel like sort of the way that you're moving in the world and that you approach your day-to-day life, has it been altered in any way just in anticipation of having to go through that same set of, oh my gosh, here we go again?
Mm-hmm. For me, it makes me want to be more loving and more connected and more put myself out there more, because I know that that's the only way forward. You can't fight fire with fire, and I'm not interested in creating more fires. I'm really interested in the love and connections that we can foster between each other. I mean, it sounds so La La Land and simplistic and idealistic, but it's true. These things, they break my heart, you know, when supposed Muslims perpetrate these horrible acts. It really does. It breaks me. And what it does is I have to build my heart back up. And what that does, it's like Rumi said, you know, the cracks are where the light comes in. And my heart only grows back bigger every time. And I know that my mission in life is to love. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything but that in this world. And that's the only way we're going to get through this as a country, you know, as a human family, all of it.
That was very beautiful. Sebastian, do you want to follow from
that? I obviously agree with everything my wife said. I aspire to be as loving as she is. And I think I'm really trying to focus on the stories that are coming out and the stories that actually are not about Islam. The fact that we're actually talking about mental health, the fact that we're talking about gun control, perhaps in a very serious way. I don't want to get my hopes up about that. The fact that we're talking about homophobia, you know, these are things that are just easy to gloss over. So there was a sense of dread that this had happened again. And there was also a sense of, well, gosh, we got through it. We actually came through united. There were some beautiful things that have happened in the last 6 months. And my hope and prayer is that can happen again now.
Well, Sebastian Robbins and Mona Haidar are the Duxbury couple who have the Ask a Muslim booth or table. As we've been saying, they've set it up around the Boston area at various times where you can engage in some hopefully community-building dialogue with them. In just a second, do you know when you might set up the next one and where?
We're hoping to be out this weekend, and we've actually been a little hesitant to broadcast time and location for security reasons.
Okay. And for fun.
But look for us this Saturday. Look for a giant rainbow flag and a dog and some donuts.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us. Appreciate it.
All right, well, let's shift gears here a bit and turn our attention to the world of tech, which is still buzzing with the news that Microsoft is going to buy LinkedIn for a whopping $26.2 billion. That makes the purchase the third largest acquisition in the history of the tech industry. Here's Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella announcing the big buy on Monday.
Today is a massive day for the world's professionals. We're bringing together the leading professional cloud and the professional network.
All right, a massive day, he says, but let's hear what Hiawatha Bray thinks about it. He's technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hi there, Hiawatha.
Hello there. He's right. It is a massive day, as you said. It's an absolutely huge acquisition. So huge that you're wondering what Microsoft was thinking.
So what were they thinking?
Well, no, actually, what they're thinking makes a lot of sense. My questions about it come with, you know, for example, the price that they paid, $26 billion, is immense for a giant address book, but it is not an ordinary run-of-the-mill address book. You have to understand that LinkedIn is like Facebook for people with real money to spend. It is this social network that has the identities and the facts, the information, the personal stories, and the connections of about 433 million people in the world of business all over the world. These people voluntarily log on to LinkedIn and tell the world a lot about themselves, where they worked in the past, who they know, what jobs they do, what kind of products they buy, all that kind of stuff. They want the world to know this, or they want other business people to know it. Now Microsoft knows it, and that could be hugely profitable if Microsoft can figure out how to use it.
Okay, so you answered my question I was going to ask about. This seems like a really niche purchase, but I hear you saying that it's
the right niche.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's the right niche.
Yeah.
Microsoft. See, one of the things you've got to understand about Microsoft, because Microsoft is one of these companies that has embedded itself into the lives of ordinary people to an amazing degree. But what we have to remember is that first and foremost, Microsoft is a company that sells to businesses. Mm-hmm. Most of its profit is dealing with large companies, governments, the enterprise, as it's called in the world. And Microsoft also has made this major and very smart shift. They are now trying to orient everything they do around the internet, as it's called, the cloud. And this is all part of a huge strategic shift that has come in since Satya Nadella took over from Steve Ballmer.
So does that mean that everyone on LinkedIn...
I think he's done a great job.
Well, but Hiawatha, I'm curious. Yeah. Does everyone on LinkedIn now have to worry that they're going to get hit with lots of ads and calls and LinkedIn requests selling, Microsoft Cloud services?
Well, you know, they're going to have to be very careful about that. And Microsoft says they are not going to be doing that kind of thing. But what you got to remember is almost everybody who would be on LinkedIn is probably using Microsoft to some extent already. See, one of the reasons that this makes sense for Microsoft is, first of all, people who are not already signed up to LinkedIn, chances are they work in a corporate environment where Microsoft is already selling stuff. So Microsoft can go in there and get more people to sign up to LinkedIn. Secondly, now people who use Microsoft products can now get all that data that they can pull in from LinkedIn, so that when you contact a person, you not only know information about this person you're trying to sell stuff to, you also know all the people he knows.
Right.
You know his areas of expertise. You know all these things that can help you make more sales. And this could be, if used properly, a very lucrative move. The problem is, as a lot of people have pointed out, first, they paid an immense amount of money for this.
It's a very expensive address book, like you keep saying.
Oh, absolutely. They paid 50% over the product's own stock value. And that was after its stock value had plummeted late last year because they were warning that they were no longer growing very fast. The company isn't really profitable. And everybody was saying, well, LinkedIn is a niche and it's not really going anywhere. And Microsoft buys it at this very high price. And a lot of people are wondering what they were thinking. And also, Microsoft has had a terrible track record with major acquisitions. They bought the cell phone company Nokia. Gone. They just had to give up on it. They bought a little-known advertising company called Aquantive for like $6 or $7 billion. Gone. It has not worked for them. And so Microsoft is going to have a real challenge figuring out how to make this pay.
Well,
everybody's worried about.
Let me jump in here, Hiawatha, because I'm curious about what this means from LinkedIn's perspective. I mean, obviously, hooray, they got bought for $26 billion. But LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner says that, quote, imagine a world where we're no longer looking up at tech titans such as Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook, and wondering what it would be like to operate at their extraordinary scale because we're one of them. I mean, does he see growth?
Well, they are now one of them. Well, that was their goal, and they are now going to be able, like I said, to take advantage of that immense network of companies that Microsoft does business with. They do business with virtually everybody, and now LinkedIn has access to all those companies that Microsoft is already working with. In addition, LinkedIn is going to be integrated into every piece of software that Microsoft makes. For example, you know about Cortana, their speech recognition system, sort of like Siri. Mm-hmm. Now, if you talk to Cortana, what's going to happen is, like, if you're going into a meeting, you say, I'm at a meeting at XYZ Corporation. What can you tell me about the people there? And you get a complete readout of all the key executives, what they do, where they used to work, who they know, all that stuff pops up on your screen instantly. That is going to be an immensely powerful informational tool for people, and that's what Microsoft is looking forward to.
Hiawatha, a couple seconds. I just want to throw one last thing at you. The Economist is saying that this could signal an impending tech buying spree. Yay or nay?
Well, maybe. I honestly do not know.
Maybe.
I mean, I'm not sure who else is out there that would attract this kind of attention. Although some people still think that Microsoft might end up trying to buy Salesforce.com, which is a company they were looking at the past for much the same reason. And because Microsoft, this is their bread and butter from here on out, and they need to become a full-fledged power in cloud delivery of services to business. So, yeah, I can't say, but it's possible.
Hiawatha Bray is the tech writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. We've got a link to his column about Microsoft's acquisition of LinkedIn. That's at our website, wbur.org/Radio Boston. Hiawatha, always great to talk with you. Are we LinkedIn, by the way?
I'm in LinkedIn. Are you?
I don't know if we're LinkedIn.
I'll have to get LinkedIn.
We'll have to figure that out. Thanks again.
Okay.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Right. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Kevin Pierce and Bobby Scales, two young men growing up in Brighton. It's the 1970s. There's violence, drugs, racial tensions exploding around the busing crisis. But Kevin is destined to get out of the neighborhood and onto better things. Unfortunately, the same can't be said for Bobby. The two, however, are united by a terrible crime. They're separated, then brought back together in the early 2000s by another series of terrible crimes. Well, that's the alluring promise of Brighton, a new crime novel by Chicago writer Michael Harvey. And before you start yelling back at the radio, hey, what's some guy from Chicago doing thinking he can write about Brighton? Well, you got a point. I mean, Michael Harvey does live in Chicago now, but he is Brighton-born and bred, and he joins us. Michael Harvey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. That's Pocket great. Car and Harvard Yard. Still got the accent, so.
Yeah. We definitely acknowledge that you've got the full Boston, specifically Brighton cred. So it's great to have you, and thank you so much for this really fascinating book. It's engrossing, and I don't want to give away too much of the plot. I gave us some broad brush strokes here.
Yes,
But give me the quick story. What inspired you to write about your home neighborhood?
Well, you know, I wanted to write a neighborhood book, and I wanted to write a childhood book. And I knew it was going to be Brighton because that's where I grew up. I mean, it's I think when you grow up in those neighborhoods, they get into your bones, they get into your DNA, and it's just hard to get rid of it. And you know you don't want to get rid of it. So when I knew I was going to write that kind of book, I just figured it was going to be in Brighton. Mm-hmm. It was going to be where I grew up. You know, I was reading an interview from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and he said that you know, your childhood is your childhood until it becomes something else. And for a writer, it becomes literature. And for me, it became the backdrop for the best kind of literature, which is a crime novel.
Yeah.
So I was really happy to do it. Once I started writing it, you know, my parents still live in Brighton and my family still lives in and around Brighton. Once I started writing it, all the Boston stuff was just right there. And so it was really interesting and fun book to write.
So you grew up in the exact same time period that the first part of the book is set, in the 70s in Brighton. Tell us, did you know? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on the street, on the block where a lot of the novel unfolds. I just figured, what the heck, I know the geography there, so I'll just set it there. But yeah, right in that time period, I grew up in a three-decker, in a two-bedroom apartment. My mom and my dad slept in one room, and there were six of us sleeping in the other room. And by the end of our time there, and it was kind of like that up and down the block. There were kids everywhere. You spent a lot of time on the street. The kids you knew on the street sort of became an extended family for you. And so it was fun for us. I don't know how much fun it was for my parents, but it was certainly fun for us. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot going on. I mean, I tell people that if you took a picture of 20 of us that were hanging out on the corner playing ball or hanging out on the street, about half of them will have gone on to have incredible lives, to have families and businesses and careers. And another third to a half, also wonderful people, were dead or in prison by the time they hit 30. Hmm. And that was just the reality of the life there. And none of us were aware of the various ways that life would diverge and branch off at that time. And so, but that's what happens. And why one kid goes one way, one kid goes another way is one of the themes in the book. Sometimes it's just a matter of wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
It's just as easy as that.
Well, so tell me, I mean, you kind of hinted at this, but tell me more, because I'm curious. I mean, the two main characters in the book, Kevin Pierce and Bobby Scales, who I intro'd very briefly at the top of this conversation. Kevin, you know, he does go on to bigger and better things. Bobby, as you write, he sort of survives the foster care system and stays in the neighborhood. I mean, did you specifically know young people like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I remember being 12, 13 years old and sitting there and talking to kids that I grew up with who just could see no life beyond, you know, what their parents had and what had gone on in the family and beyond Brighton. And, you know, they would say, well, I lived here. I'm born here. I'm going to live here. I'm going to die here. I'm going to work on cars, or I'm going to work on this, or I'm going to be in a carpenter. And I'm like, well, what about college? And what about this? And what about all these other possibilities in life? And some kids were open to that. Some kids weren't. Some kids were pretty matter of fact about, no, this is what I'm going to do, and this is going to be my life. And they weren't sad about it or angry or bitter, or they're just very, very matter of fact about it. And, some of that, I don't know. I don't know exactly why one person feels one way about themselves and, you know, someone feels differently. But he certainly had some of that in the neighborhood. And then there were other kids who were just, you know, frankly, looking to get out or looking for education or looking for an opportunity to live a little bit larger life.
Yeah. So you set the first part of the book, again, in the mid-70s, right around the time of busing. So race does play a very strong role in the novel, Brighton. In the second part of the book, Kevin's girlfriend, I believe, she's an African-American ADA who was also bused. That's an experience that you actually had, right?
Well, yeah, I was voluntarily bused. I mean, yeah. I went to Boston Latin School, which is your audience probably knows, founded in 1635, yep. Oldest public school in the country,
yep.
and changed my life and changed the life of countless other Bostonians. But it's an exam school and it's a voluntary school, but you do get bused. I was bused across. I took a bus every day across the city to get there. And my last 3 years at Latin School were the first 3 years of forced busing in Boston. And certainly taking a bus across the city and then going to Latin school. And right across the street from us was Boston English at the time, which was primarily African-American. And there was certainly tension between the two schools. There was, you know, a series of incidents, out in the street and just in the neighborhood. And there were, I remember, a couple days where we had some police in the school and some metal detectors in the school and things like that. It was nothing like the two epicenters of, you know, Salty and Charlestown and the stuff that was going on there. But if you were in the neighborhoods and you're in the public school system, you certainly felt that tension. You felt it in Brighton. I mean, you felt it everywhere in the city. There was all of this racial tension and continuing series of incidents over really a couple of years. And a lot of kids at Latin School that I knew in my class dropped out. They dropped out of, you know, quote unquote solidarity with what was going on in other parts of the city. And they never came back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what happened to them and what happened to their lives, I don't know. But it certainly was a big part of my growing up at that time, and I think anyone who was in the public Boston public school system at the time. I mean, at the time, honestly, I remember thinking at 13 years old that this was a fatally flawed plan. I really felt like they were taking a bunch of poor kids from one underperforming school and busing them to another underperforming school in the city. And why not take all of the poor kids, black and white, and put them on buses out to Newton and Wellesley and Brookline and where all the good schools are anyways. So I think I saw it more as a socioeconomic problem as well as a racial problem.
Yeah.
And you know, that wasn't happening at that time. And and so eventually, you know, the whole thing just kind of imploded.
Yeah. You know, you've had a really interesting career, Michael. You were a lawyer, right? And then an Emmy Award-winning television producer. And you've produced a bunch of series about cold cases, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So and then obviously you've written other very well-received novels, crime novels. But most of those were notably the series about Michael Kelly, a former Chicago cop. They're all set in Chicago.
Yes.
So you've got this well-developed career. I'm curious why now felt like the right time to return to Brighton as finally the right time to write this book.
I don't know. I guess I just wanted to write a childhood book. The Kelly novels deal with kind of what I call institutional crime. Mm-hmm. The mayor, like big issue crime, the mayor, downtown, city hall. And I covered that in Chicago, and I've covered a lot of major crime stuff around the country. I've interviewed a lot of cops, a lot of killers, been on death row, been in a lot of big time lockups. And the Kelly books, which I love, reflect that reality, my reality as an adult. And I wanted to write a book where it was reflecting more of my childhood and more of just a different sort of sensitivity. And I really wanted to capture Brighton because I really felt like, I feel like those neighborhoods, all of them, Salty Charlestown, Brighton, all of them have been sort of gentrified.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I saw is gone, has rubbed away with time. And that's not a bad thing, but they're not there. And so one of the wonderful things that writers try to do is capture a period of time and just sort of pin it to a page.
Yeah.
And then close that book and just capture it there so that when a reader opens it a year from now or 10 years or even 100 years from now, it just pops up off the page and comes to life again and fills up the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would love to be able to do that even just once or twice in your novels. And so I really wanted to try and capture a little bit of Brighton and a little bit of the authenticity of what that time was like. In this particular book, among many other things I was trying to do, that was certainly one of my goals.
Well, so that's really interesting because, of course, the second half of the book, the latter portion of the book, takes place in 2001, right? Mm-hmm. Or just after
2002.
Yeah. 2002, yeah. So you bring it forward in time a lot. But, of course, one of the themes and the thing that brings Kevin and Bobby back together is that the past is never fully past with the two of them.
So
that made me wonder, you know, you're right. These neighborhoods in Boston have been very profoundly transformed and are changing, it seems, ever faster with every passing year. But is there still the sense of the past for people like your family who have lived in the neighborhood for so long? I mean, when you go back, what do you see? What do you feel when you're there?
Well, I'll be back next week, so I'll see if all the locks have changed. And I know they're still about. No, they... No, I think so. More so than any other city, I think Boston is very, very much, I mean, you tell me, very much attuned with their past.
Yeah.
I mean, Boston people, whether it's a sports team or politics or the geography of the place or, you know, the Irish in Boston know more about their Irish heritage than anywhere I know in the country. And so, you know, Boston is a city that understands and embraces and loves its past. And yet, in many ways, I think it's also haunted by it and defined by it in a way that sometimes is troubling. When you look at all the films and the novels that have been done about Boston, and there have been a lot of wonderful ones, that theme is always there a lot. The past coming back all the time, because when you get in, especially when you get into the neighborhoods, it's not just the big city. Each neighborhood has its own defined sort of mood and atmosphere. And everybody in the neighborhood, if you grew up in that neighborhood, they know every street, they know every block, they know every family, and you live that. And sometimes you can't escape that. And like I said, that can be both a blessing and a curse. And sometimes people try to escape it, and they spend their whole life just living in that shadow. So I think that's a big part of Boston just being drenched in its own history, both for good and bad. And it's endlessly fascinating, I think, to writers to think about that and write about it.
So what about the crime novel aspect of it? Because it is a crime novel. Yeah. One reviewer described it as blood-soaked. We were trying to find a portion of it for you to read, which would be radio-friendly. We're having a bit of a trouble doing that. Why do you think people are, I mean, so you just wrote about the attraction as a writer, but why do you think people are so attracted as readers to reading crime novels?
I've done a lot of stuff in the real world of crime. Okay, I've interviewed a lot of cops, a lot of killers, a lot of serial killers, and I can't tell you how many people come up to me for Cold Case Files, the series that I did, and want to talk about stuff in just about killers, okay, and about people that I've covered, and the same thing with the novels. And I think it's because, you know, honestly, everybody thinks and wonders if they have a little bit of that in themselves. I mean, nobody's pure good, no one's pure evil, and in your novels, you try to make your characters a wonderful mix, and that's kind of what goes on. That's what I try to do to books, and I think that's what people are really interested in. They want to look at Hannibal Lecter, and they want to say, wow, is there a little bit of that in me?
Well, I wonder what they'll see when they read about Bobby Scales. Michael Harvey, yeah. The new novel is called Brighton, and he will be talking about the book at two events next week at the Boston Public Library branch in Brighton on Tuesday and at the Brookline Booksmith on Thursday. We have information about that at radioboston.org or wbur.org/radioboston. Michael Harvey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.